Jewish Education and Media is pleased to present L'Chaim, a program that highlights the people, issues, and events of importance to the Jewish community. Now here is your host, Rabbi Mark Golub.
I'm Mark Golub, and most often on L'Chaim, I have the opportunity of introducing you to someone whom you may not know very well, or perhaps you don't know at all. But on this edition of L'Chaim, it's just the opposite. I have the enormous pleasure of sitting with a man you know very, very well. He's one of the few on the American Jewish scene known intimately by the American Jewish community at large, and who is enormously appreciated for his outspoken, articulate, brilliant defense of the State of Israel, as he is known in the greater American community as one of the iconic defenders of civil liberties, legal justice, and constitutional law. He's a man you've seen and heard countless times on JBS. And if you watch L'Chaim often, you know he is, along with Jackie Robinson, Elie Wiesel, and Menachem Begin, one of my all-time lifelong heroes. Of course, I'm speaking about Alan Dershowitz, professor emeritus at Harvard Law School, now a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, and a most highly prolific author who's written more than 40 books on a wide range of legal subjects, accounts of his most high-profile cases, including the successful appeal of Klaus Van Bülow, involved in the conviction for his attempted murder of his wife, Sunny, and the 1995 O.J. Simpson murder trial. Alan has written on civil liberties, constitutional law, and Jewish law. He's written a novel, he's written an opera, and he's written a number of wonderful books about Jewish life in America. Alan's first appearance on L'Chaim was in 1991, after writing what has now become a Jewish classic, Chutzpah, on what it means to be a Jew in America at the close of the 20th century, followed in 1997 by another Jewish classic, The Vanishing American Jew, in search of a Jewish identity for the next century. And Alan has authored a series of definitive books regarding the legitimacy of the State of Israel, including The Case for Israel, as well as The Case Against Israel's Enemies, Exposing Jimmy Carter and Others Who Stand in the Way of Peace, The Case for Moral Clarity, Israel, Hamas, and Gaza, and Terror Tunnels, The Case for Israel's Just War Against Hamas, and The Case Against BDS, Why Singling Out Israel for Boycott is Anti-Semitic. And now, Alan's most recent book on his long and illustrious relationship with Israel is a fabulous, marvelous memoir entitled Defending Israel, The Story of My Relationship with My Most Challenging Client. Defending Israel, its relationship, it's all about who and what Israel is. There has not been a better book written about the State of Israel, its history, and where it stands today. Alan is also one who's been honored with doctorates from countless American universities. But now, in a bizarre play on the titles of one of his earlier books, Reversal of Fortune, Alan Dershowitz, in the blink of an eye, has gone from being one of the most highly respected liberal figures in the Jewish community and the leading speaker on issues relating to the State of Israel, a sought-after speaker by every national Jewish conference, synagogues, federations, at parlor meetings for wealthy Jewish homes, Alan Dershowitz has suddenly become a persona non grata in the liberal Jewish community, where age-old friends have made him a pariah. And why? Because Alan Dershowitz had the courage, the chutzpah, to tell the truth about the legitimacy of efforts to impeach an American president. And by the way, it didn't matter that Alan voted for Hillary Clinton, currently supports the candidacy of Joe Biden for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Nor does it matter that he has been a serious critic of Donald Trump, both personally and as a president. The only thing that mattered to Jews who consider themselves liberal is that Alan Dershowitz spoke out and wrote passionately about the American commitment to the Constitution, to due process of law, and against politically weaponizing the law. For the crime of arguing against the impeachment of Donald Trump, articulated in his current book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, Alan Dershowitz is suddenly portrayed as a traitor to the liberal cause and the Democratic Party. I am so grateful that I have you at this table to talk about some of the things that you've dealt with. You've heard me say on JBS before, it infuriates me for you, but I cannot tell you how much I admire the courage and your willingness to continue to speak out on what you believe is right and not to buckle. Speak for a moment to me and the audience. What's it been like for you personally to have so many of your dear friends who admired you as a liberal icon now basically not want nothing to do with you?
They never understood me. They always liked me because they thought I was on their side of political issues. They forget that even when Richard Nixon was being impeached back in the 1970s, although I supported his impeachment, I think he committed impeachable crimes, I was on the national board of the ACLU, and I insisted that the ACLU stand up for his civil liberties and make sure the Constitution was protected, make sure we didn't rush to do something that would create a terrible precedent for the Constitution. And now with President Trump, I voted for Hillary Clinton. The original title for my book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, was The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton, because I thought she'd get elected. The Republicans had promised to impeach her. I'm an expert on impeachment. I've taught about impeachment. I've written about impeachment. And I don't want to see impeachment used except in extraordinary cases. It was misused against Bill Clinton. It was actually misused against Andrew Johnson. The only person ever properly subject to impeachment in American history was Richard Nixon. And he, of course, understood that, and he resigned. So I'm going to continue to argue for my principles. My friends and my acquaintances are going to have to take me as I am. They have to understand that I'm a man of principle. I live a principled life, and I'm going to continue to stand up for what I believe in, regardless of partisan impact.
Did it surprise you? I'm assuming, by the way, it doesn't matter how much courage you have or what you're. It's not pleasant. It's hurtful. To you, it may have been hurtful to members of your family. Did you see it come? Would you have expected this?
I expected some pushback, but I didn't expect people to demand trigger warnings. They now have to know if I'm going to be at an event, because they won't show up if I'm at the event. Not only won't they talk to me or engage with me, but they want to make sure that everybody else shuns me and doesn't engage with me. I have a funny story about that. The last day I was on Martha's Vineyard this summer, some guy came up to me and he gave me the finger. And I said, that's very articulate, but is that for Israel? Is it for Trump? Is it for Epstein? He looked at me and said, well, I guess all three. So, you know, look, I've always lived a life.
But this is Martha's Vineyard. You know, when I was growing up, there were a set of liberal principles that my parents raised me with. And it was a commitment to a certain way in which you expected the country to operate. My parents never used the word constitutional law. But the rule of law, which became such a catchphrase during the Nixon era. And it was then that I heard for the first time, no one is above the law, not even the president.
Right.
And we were taught that that was true, but it was supposed to be for everybody, no matter who was the president.
Right.
And what disappoints me now is that people who I love, Alan, I love, I respect, who are bright, intelligent Jews are willing to sacrifice, literally willing to sacrifice, all kinds of principle because they believe there's a higher good. The higher good is getting rid of Donald Trump.
Look, I grew up with this.
The end now justifies the means in ways that we were taught should never be true.
Not only that, but I grew up during McCarthyism, in which people took the same position. There was a higher good. You have to get rid of the communists. It didn't matter whether you violated the free speech rights. It didn't matter whether you violated the due process rights. When I was the president of the student government at Brooklyn College, they were firing professors for refusing to testify in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. I supported the professors, and the president of Brooklyn College wouldn't write me a recommendation for law school. He thought I was a supporter of communism. We hated communism in my house. Stalin was, next to Hitler, the worst enemy in the world. But I believe that people should not be punished for expressing views I disagreed with, and that was the liberal perspective. I'm working on a new book called Why I Left the Left But Couldn't Join the Right. So many people I know have that feeling. It's hard to join the right because we support a woman's right to choose, we support gay marriage, we support social gun control, environmental control, but I can't stay with the squad that is so anti-Israel and the people on the extreme left that are intolerant of free speech, of due process. So I feel homeless politically.
I
want to be back. I want to thrive at the center like we used to.
I understand.
Yeah.
By the way, it's interesting that you say that the assault on free speech, which you have championed for more than 50 years, the assault is coming from the left.
It is. And one of the worst offenders is the American Civil Liberties Union, that I was a proud national board member. And they're violating free speech rights and due process rights in the interest of getting Trump. And that's where they make their money. Or I'll give you another institution that has violated free speech rights, which I have been a long supporter of, and that is the 92nd Street Y. I have been, after Elie Wiesel, the most popular speaker at the 92nd Street Y, every year they ask me to speak. Obviously, when I write a book called Defending Israel, you would think it would be the most natural thing in the world for me to speak at the Y about Israel, but they've banned me. They will not allow me to speak.
I want the audience to understand, what do you literally mean that you have been banned? Did somebody go on the phone and said, we will not let you go? Or was it that they said to you something like, oh, we're terribly sorry, Alan, our schedule is booked this year?
Well, of course they said their schedule is booked. So I said, well, what about next year? What about the year after? Usually they would allow me to speak, even if I said I want to speak in 2 weeks, there's always enough room there. But then off the record, they made it clear that because of guilt by accusation, because I have been falsely accused of having sex with somebody I never met, and I prove it categorically in this book. I have an admission by the woman that she never met me on emails. I have an admission by her lawyer on tape that it would be impossible for me to have met her and that she's wrong, simply wrong. I have a thorough investigation by the director of the FBI. I have all of her statements accusing people over the years of having sex with her, never mentioning me, always saying she never met me. So there's never been a case a greater overwhelming innocence, but that's not enough for the Y. What the Y basically said is, we know you're innocent. We know you didn't do it, but you've been accused. And if you're accused, that's enough to cancel your whole life. That's enough to put everything you've done on the wayside. And you're not going to speak again anymore at the Y. And that is McCarthyism at its worst.
Okay, and I just want to clarify. Did somebody, even off the record, say it to you that clearly?
That clearly. Off the record.
You know, that's outrageous.
It's outrageous.
It's outrageous. By the way, the book, Guilt by Accusation, has to do with, as Alan just said, the fact that there was a woman who accused him of sexually assaulting her, in a sense, having a relationship with her inappropriately. I thought, by the way, that case was already done.
It was done.
And it was over.
It was over.
I was so happy for you. It was thrown out.
The lawyers withdrew it.
Yes.
The judge threw it out.
So
then came the Me Too movement. Because I truthfully denied, any knowledge of her, she sued me now for defamation. And so now she sued me, I sued her.
This is ludicrous.
It's ludicrous.
This is ludicrous.
But it's dangerous. Because I have lived a life of complete honor and probity. I've been married to the same woman for 30-something years. From the day I met Jeffrey Epstein till today, I've touched one woman, my wife. I don't flirt. I don't hug. I don't touch. And if I could be falsely accused, Anybody can be falsely accused. Your father, your brother, your uncle, your nephew could be falsely accused. And if I can't prove my innocence, having this overwhelming evidence, you know, I keep travel records of everywhere I've ever gone. And I showed the travel records to her lawyer, and he agreed with me. Said it's impossible that you could have been in the exotic places she said she may. Doesn't matter. Evidence doesn't matter. If you're accused, you're guilty. Hence the title of my book, Guilt by Accusation. It affects every single person in America, because if I can be falsely accused, anyone can be falsely accused.
What was your attitude to the Kavanaugh hearings?
I didn't like the way they were conducted. I have no idea what happened, but it was many, 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 many years ago. The allegations were vague and nonspecific, and I hope he'll be a great justice.
Mm-hmm. If you had been in the Senate, you would not have had a trouble confirming him.
Not at all. First of all, the president gets to appoint his justices to the Supreme
Court.
Yes, but
that's if you thought he was guilty of gross violations of another person.
That would be different. That would be different.
But you didn't.
I didn't see the evidence.
Okay.
I didn't see the case.
Okay.
I thought it was a weak case.
Okay. And the Me Too.
But the difference, of course, is he lived that life. He was a high school kid who drank too much. I never did.
Right.
I never had sex with an underage person in my life, even when I was an underage person. But I have to tell you, I will never get another honorary degree in my life. I will never be invited to speak at another college campus. I will never be invited to speak at the 92nd Street Y. All of this, what they're trying to do is cancel my 55 years of accomplishments because of a false accusation. Now, I have demanded an FBI investigation of me. I have demanded the U.S. attorney investigate me, the district attorney investigate me. I have nothing to hide. I'm an open book, but they won't investigate me. And at the trial, one of us will be committing perjury. I will swear to God that I never met this woman, and she'll swear she had sex with me 7 times in exotic places, including in a car in front of my house in Cambridge. And then she said she went into my house where my wife had a professional office, where my daughter was a child and had an au pair, and where we had video camera surveillance. So matter what the evidence
is, of course,
people are going to believe it.
I'm going to predict it'll never go to trial.
Well, I hope you're right.
It's too open and shut for me. Is it possible, by the way, that this is a moment in time and that this literal lunacy will pass and that the Y will say... But they'll never say they're sorry.
No.
But suddenly you'll get an invitation.
I don't know. It's possible, but I don't know. The thing that's so upsetting about the Y is the people who are most focusing on these accusations are the anti-Israel people. Mondo Weiss and other websites say we're trying to silence Dershowitz's voice. He's too articulate on behalf of Israel. And the Y is now helping them. The Y is now helping them silence my voice on Israel.
Yes.
And that's a terrible thing. And also, people hope I'm guilty because of my views on Trump's constitutional rights. So it's a trifecta. When you combine the accusation, my support for Trump's constitutional rights, and my support for Israel, it's a perfect storm. And people want to see me silenced. But the idea that the 92nd Street Y would be complicit in that effort to silence me is beyond contemptuous.
You should tell our audience also, what is your view in general, not about Alan Dershowitz, but in general, about this very tricky issue when a woman claims she has been sexually assaulted by a man and there's no one there to witness it?
First of all, it's not only women, it's men too. Men have been assaulted. We know there have been scandals within the Jewish community regarding young boys and men, and I think every victim
should be taken. In a homosexual situation.
Yeah. All alleged victims, all complainants should be taken seriously. Everything should be investigated. But once the investigation occurs and you discover that the woman has a long history of lying about prominent people, that she has a record of saying she never met the person, then you stop believing her. And you start believing the person who has the evidence on his side. You can't allow the Me Too movement, which is a good movement. I support it. I think it's very important for women to come forward and talk about abusive men. But if the evidence shows a long history of lying on the woman's part and conclusive documentary evidence that it couldn't have happened, You got to not believe the person. There's no gene associated with lying or telling the truth that's gender specific.
When my parents raised me and my brother, and my brother became a wonderful lawyer who at different times in his career specialized in different aspects of the law. For a while he was doing criminal law and criminal defense. And there was a principle we were taught. We were taught that the system needed to be protected. And therefore, if a person is charged with a very serious crime, mm-hmm. even if we have the public's perception is there's an overwhelming probability that this person is guilty, that person must still be defended and has the right for a good counsel.
Right.
One of my earliest conversations with you when we were doing L'Chaim on radio before it became television, mm-hmm. I said to you, one of the things you've been criticized for is defending people who are notorious.
Right.
Okay. And O.J. Simpson is the classic case. How
sure.
could Alan Dershowitz have ever been part of the Dream Team?
Mm-hmm.
And this now spills over to Epstein.
Right.
The fact that you had an instance where you defended him, you
right.
were his lawyer. I don't know the extent to which you ever became personal friends with him, but you may have been a personal friend with him.
No, I was an academic acquaintance, but once he was arrested, my acquaintanceship with him ended and it became professional.
Okay.
I represented him. He paid me for every minute I spent on his
okay.
case.
So let me finish my
yep.
question. My
yep.
question is, I remember vividly once saying to you, and so, Alan, if you'd been in the Nuremberg trials and somebody said to you, Adolf Hitler mm-hmm. requires a defense,
mm-hmm.
would, in principle, you be willing to defend him?
I wouldn't, because I would have a conflict of interest.
Okay.
He murdered my family.
Okay.
And so,
so it's
I would
a conflict
feel so
of interest.
Emotional
okay.
about him. If he had called me to be his lawyer in 1943, I would have said, sure, I'll come to the meeting, and then I would have tried to strangle him with my bare hands, not as a lawyer, but as a Jew and as a human being. It would have been my greatest honor and pleasure in the world to kill Adolf Hitler. So no, I wouldn't represent
okay.
him in 1943 or 1944
okay.
or
and
1945.
Just so you know, that's what you said to me
yeah.
umpteen years ago
right.
on radio.
Right.
But it was almost like that was the only instance that I could get you to say you would not.
Well, I have rules. I don't represent people who are ongoing criminals, who are in the business of committing crimes or involved in crimes that are continuing, terrorists, drug dealers, genocidal killers. I don't represent people who are fugitives. I don't represent people who intimidate witnesses or who try to abuse the system. But I will represent anybody, no matter how serious the crime is. I've learned from experience. I represented a man some years ago who was accused of murdering his wife. It turned out he had nothing to do with it. She died of arrhythmia. I represented a woman who was accused of murdering her husband. It turned out he died of a self-inflicted drug overdose. So I've had innocent people whose lives I've saved over the years. And as the Talmud says, he who saves a single human life, I've been privileged to save multiple human lives of people who have been falsely accused of murder. And that's, to me, been a great, great pleasure. I helped save the life of two Jewish refuseniks, Kuznetsov and Dimshitz, who were facing the death penalty in Russia for trying to steal an airplane and bring some Jews out to Sweden. So I've had the great honor and pleasure of saving people's lives. Not many lawyers can do that. I've also defended guilty people and gotten them off. That's part of the system. Better 10 guilty go free than one innocent be wrongly convicted.
Isn't
I live
so
by
true?
That. Yes. And the Torah says that. Avraham arguing with Hashem. Hasho fate kol haaretz lo yaaseh mishpat. What if there are 50, 40, 30, 20? I wrote a book on Abraham called Abraham, the world's first but certainly not last Jewish lawyer. I live by the story of Saddam.
Okay. And what do you say when people say, Alan, what are you doing representing Epstein?
Doing my job, trying to get it. Remember, he went to prison. They had a very strong state case, very weak federal case. I worked along with Kent Starr, with Marty Weinberg, with Jerry Lefkowitz, with Jay Lefkowitz. We put together a legal team. We did our job. That's what lawyers do.
And okay.
I'm proud of the job I did.
And he had the right to the best legal defense he could afford.
That's right. And I wouldn't do anything unethical or improper in defending him or anybody else. But I will follow the law and ethics and do whatever I can to defend somebody who's falsely accused or who's truthfully accused, because I don't usually know. And when Epstein was arrested, the allegations against him were very minor. A handful of young women, most of whom over the age, giving him massages, which became erotic massages. Only years later did it turn out this was a massive scheme involving many, many, many hundreds of young women. We had no idea about
okay.
that.
Okay. And you were not visiting his island.
Oh, no.
To engage in this.
No. The only time I ever set foot on the island was my wife and my daughter. We were vacationing in the Caribbean. He had just bought the island. He invited us to have dinner with Michael Porter, a professor at Harvard, and his wife and two other members of the family. We were there for a few hours, and that was the only time I ever set foot on the island with my wife and daughter, right?
Okay, so I want to talk to you for a few minutes about how you view this impeachment process of Donald Trump and why you've tried to say, although you are not a fan, you didn't vote for him, you don't support him, on matters of constitutional principle, mm-hmm. you are opposed. I want to take you through this a little bit step by step.
Okay, but I want to make one correction. I oppose many of his policies. I oppose his policies on the environment, on immigration. But I support many of his policies. I support recognition of Jerusalem. I was there at the opening of the embassy. I support the recognition of the Golan Heights annexation. I support the fact that the settlements, although I oppose the settlements personally, they're not illegal. They're not in violation of international law. I supported his statement about anti-Semitism on university campuses. For me, bipartisanism means you vote against somebody, but if he does something good, you support that. Or you vote for somebody, if he does something bad, like Barack Obama did in the last days of his presidency, saying that the Kotel was illegally occupied territory, you oppose that. So, but I separate out my politics from my constitutional analysis.
Okay, and following up on that thought, there are Jews who would say to you, Trump is so bad as a human being, mm-hmm. He is not qualified to be president, but that's not the issue. Mm-hmm. The issue is they feel he is a bad human being, and they revile him.
Mm-hmm. That's a good reason for voting against him.
That's right. But they often say to me, mm-hmm. even if he does the right thing, he's the wrong person.
Well, look what happened when he recognized Jerusalem. 80-something percent of American Jews wanted Obama to recognize Jerusalem. And if he had done so, he'd get universal
support.
Had Obama done so. But then Trump does the same thing. And the same 80% who would have supported it if it had been done by Obama oppose it. And so it's very personal. And Trump does bring out very strong feelings, I know, among people. But I'm going to continue to defend the Constitution. And if it means that my defense of the Constitution comes out on Trump's side, so be it. I don't make decisions based on partisanship. I make it based on my own constitutional analysis.
So there was the Mueller report. Bottom line, if somebody said to you, Alan, did the Mueller report state unequivocally that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government? Did the Mueller report say that?
Yes.
Yes. By the way. We're going to put up on screen, I want people to see this. The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. Although the investigation established that the Trump campaign expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. My question for you is, people, Jews who I love, respect, are bright, educated? If you ask them now, they will tell you, oh no, the Mueller report did find that Trump colluded. And by the way, they will say, that's why so many indictments were handed down of Trump associates in his campaign, from Manafort and Flynn and Papadopoulos and then Roger Stone. And I want you to address that. Why do you think it is that although the report clearly says there was no collusion, so many American Jews cling to the notion that the Mueller report did the very opposite?
Well, I think Mueller is at fault for some of that, because although he found no evidence of collusion, there was some evidence of obstruction of justice, but not enough to warrant making that a charge. So the end of the report was that they wouldn't make a recommendation to accuse of obstruction, but they wouldn't exonerate him either. And that became very confusing.
Was it his job to exonerate?
Yeah. Well, no, it wasn't his job to exonerate, but it wasn't his job to say we don't exonerate.
Yes.
It was his job simply to marshal the evidence, and the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, Rosenstein, concluded there was insufficient evidence to go forward with any kind of a prosecution on obstruction of justice, and that would be true even if a sitting president could be indicted. So there was a lot of confusion about that. My point is simply, I don't want to see the criminal justice system or the impeachment system weaponized for partisan purposes. I want to see it reserved for extraordinary cases where a president has engaged in treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, and I don't think that standard has been met.
Take one moment. We have a sense of what treason is. Most people have a sense of bribery. We'll discuss in a moment, was there bribery in the phone call between Trump and Zelensky?
Yeah.
Okay. But high crimes and misdemeanors, to the average American, that's a very vague term. And it sounds like if you can show that a president did something certainly criminal, but even what's now being talked about is there was a gross abuse of power, and that a gross abuse of power is also falls under the rubric of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Well,
can you talk about what does that term, high crimes and misdemeanors, mean within the notion of the Constitution, and how should the average American view that concept?
Well, you should go back and look at the history. There was a great debate at the Constitutional Convention. One member said, we should impeach on grounds of maladministration and other vague, open-ended terms like abuse of power. And the father of our Constitution, James Madison, said, no, that would turn us into a parliamentary democracy in which the president serves at the will of Congress. We need specific criteria, and all the criteria are criminal. Treason is a crime. Bribery is a crime. High crimes are crimes. High misdemeanors are crimes. Misdemeanor is a species of crime.
Like what?
At common law, you could even have a capital misdemeanor. If you shot the king's deer, you could be executed for that as a misdemeanor. The difference between a misdemeanor and a felony is a felony had consequences for your family. Your blood would be attainted. They would take away your resources. Whereas a misdemeanor, you could be punished, put in jail. Remember, they didn't have a lot of prisons in those days. And you could be punished in other ways. So a misdemeanor is a crime. You read Blackstone's commentaries. I taught this for 50 years. And you see that misdemeanor is a species of crime. And so for me, the framers said you need criminal-like conduct. It has to be criminal-like. It can't be just abuse of office, maladministration, done a bad job. And both of the prior impeachments of presidents were wrong. Andrew Johnson should never have been impeached. He simply violated an unconstitutional statute of Congress. Bill Clinton committed a crime, but it was a low crime, not a high crime. Alexander Hamilton committed a crime when he was Secretary of the Treasury. He committed adultery, he admitted it. He paid extortion, hush money to keep it quiet. But then when they accused him of using federal funds to pay the extortion, he wrote an essay denying that, and he was right. That would have been a high crime. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at history. You can't just make it up as you go along. Presidents are not above the law, but neither is Congress. The framers were very worried about the House of Representatives getting out of control. They were concerned about popular democracy. That's why they had a Senate. That's why they had the Electoral College, and they were very worried about the House of Representatives. That's why they required the Senate by a two-thirds vote to approve removal of a president, for fear otherwise that it would become too partisan.
So I then hear American Jews tell me, okay, he wasn't guilty of collusion, but in the process, he was guilty of obstruction of justice. To what extent does the Mueller report sway you that he was engaged in an obstruction of justice in a way that was criminally a criminal violation?
It wasn't persuasive at all. Of all the, they listed a dozen or so elements of obstruction of justice, it was only one that had any plausibility to
Which
it
one?
At all, but that the facts didn't support it. Namely, that he told his counsel, White House counsel, McGahn, to
fire him.
To tell a story that wasn't accurate. But if you read it in context, he was telling him to tell a story to the media, to the press, not to prosecutors. The difference is Nixon told his underlings, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and others, lie to the FBI, create a cover story for me. That's obstruction of justice. Not telling the truth to the media is, unfortunately, business as usual.
Okay. You know, I say to myself, what would happen to me if I was accused of something I know I didn't do?
Yeah.
And would there be times when my frustration would prompt me to say extreme things, even if I never did them? And how frustrating it must be if you are, and you're living this right now.
Right.
You're being persecuted for something you know you didn't
Not
do.
Not only I know I didn't do it, she knows
okay.
I didn't do it.
And
her lawyers know I didn't
do
it.
I got it.
Yeah.
But in this instance, what Mueller proved was, no, Donald Trump didn't do it. And Trump knows he hasn't done it
right.
all along.
Yeah.
And in essence, even whatever he said, but nothing was ever done, literally.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the obstruction of justice.
Well, the best proof is that the Democrats didn't charge obstruction of justice in the two articles
yes,
that they're going to refer to
yes,
the Senate.
But the impeachment process now is based on a totally different incident than what was dealt with
but
in the Mueller
report.
But
they could have added that
yes, they
as
could've.
A crime, but
okay.
they didn't.
Right. One more issue about the impeachment process. There's been a lot of discussion about the FISA warrant.
Yeah.
The FBI is not allowed to spy on, surveil.
Right.
The word spy is loaded.
Of course.
They're not allowed to surveil American citizens unless there's a reason.
A good reason.
And in many instances, they have to go to a special court.
Right.
And the court must approve the warrant.
Right.
And the warrant must be verifiable. And the people who present the FISA warrant must testify, in essence, that it is verifiable. One of the things that we hear an awful lot about is something called the Steele dossier,
yeah.
which was a packet of information which a British agent receives from the Russian government and other Russian sources, which he says is unverifiable, which we now have seen the Inspector General say everybody knew it was unverifiable. We have John Brennan and we have James Comey saying one under oath, at least one of them, I don't know if Comey ever did this under oath, but he did it all the time on television, saying that the Steele dossier was not the basis of the warrant, FISA warrant, and yet the Inspector General shows us what, first of all, it was the basis,
mm-hmm.
and number two, everybody who did it knew it was ludicrous. It was from whole cloth.
Well, but you
even Steele knew it. Now, my question for you is, why is it hard for bright, lovely American Jews not to say, I hate Trump, but you know what? You can't go into court with a fake warrant, a fake document, and get a warrant that allows you to surveil mm-hmm. members of opponents' mm-hmm. presidential campaign.
Yeah. No, it's worse than that, because not only was the original FISA warrant based on material that should have been known to be questionable, but then they renewed the applications after found out. And I think the FISA court should be looking to hold some people in contempt of court for that. Because remember, the FISA applications are ex parte. There's no other side. So the court has to trust what you're saying. Is you have to lean over backwards as the inspector general, who's a good person and a very, very nonpartisan person, said you have to be specially careful and scrupulous when you're presenting something to a court in a, on an ex parte basis.
But I still want to hear you answer.
Because you're picking sides. It's Red Sox Yankees. Today with Trump, you're either on the Red Sox side or the Yankees side.
And therefore you no longer care?
You no longer
about principle?
Think about it. You think about the big principle being get Trump. No matter what. Mm-hmm. No matter what the cost is, get Trump.
Okay.
And if it violates civil liberties, if it creates a terrible precedent, we'll deal with that later.
Yes, by the way. That's said to me all the time.
Yeah. I don't live in that world.
And by the way, why is that such a danger to us down the road?
H.L. Mencken once said, the problem with civil liberties is they go after the SOBs first, and nobody cares. And then they establish the bad rule for the SOBs, and then they go after the rest of us. You know the famous statement during the Holocaust by the minister. First they came for the Jews, we weren't Jewish, we didn't care. Then they came for the gays, and they came for the communists, and when they came for us, there was nobody left to care. And for me, that's very important, as is the famous line in A Man for All Seasons, would you eliminate all the laws to get the devil? If you do, when the devil turns on you, what laws will there be to protect you?
Yes.
So it's very selfish. You know, as a civil libertarian and as a Jew, I know how important it is for the laws to be there to protect us. We live in America. It's a great country. It's a country of law. I don't like when anybody tries to be above the law, whether it be the president or members of Congress. We have to stick to the law. That's our safety. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. You must chase after justice. And justice is repeated twice because it's justice for me, but it's also justice for thee. You can't have free speech for me, but not for thee.
Yes, and I will add, there's a drash that says it's tzedek, tzedek, because it's not only the ends, but it's the means.
Of course, of course.
The Jewish tradition demands that the means never...
I'll be shnayim edim on the basis of two witnesses.
Yes.
Yes, and procedural due process. Look, I wrote a book called The Genesis of Justice, in which I trace every one of the Ten Commandments to a story in the book of Genesis. And of course, thou shalt not bear false witness comes right out of the Joseph story twice. Number one, he is the victim of bearing false witness with Potiphar's wife. And then he sets up Benjamin and plants an item in his case. So, you know, we know that from history and experience, bearing false witness is a terrible, terrible thing.
Okay, let's come quickly to a couple, the two major issues that surround the current impeachment process, which has to do with a phone call between the president and the President Trump and the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. And is there any, you've read the transcript of the call.
Yes, of course.
Is there anything in that phone call that you would say proves, not implies, not suggests, proves that Trump was trying to bribe the president of Ukraine to engage in activities with the purpose of helping him in the 2020 campaign? Is there anything in there that you say proves that?
No, but let me go beyond that. If you start questioning presidents using their power to help themselves get reelected, there wouldn't be a single president who'd be a president who'd be immune from that. Presidents make foreign policy decisions all the time to help themselves get elected. We know that from
we
history.
We know that.
Yeah. And yet here the allegation is that he was seeking a favor for us. No, I thought the call was very ambiguous, certainly not a basis for a criminal charge or an impeachment charge. Would, if the president had asked me, should I make that call? I might have very well said, no, you shouldn't make that call. But there's a big difference between political sins, those are good reasons for voting against somebody, crimes, and then impeachable crimes. And those criteria haven't been met.
Okay. One of the most fascinating pieces of this is the obstruction of Congress as an obstruction of justice charge. And we all witnessed as four eminent professors of law were brought before the Schiff Intelligence Committee hearings on impeachment. Three of them were clearly very partisan Democrats who just said, this is so, this is an open and shut case. Right. You must impeach. The fourth, Professor Turley from George Washington, is a Democrat, not a Republican.
He voted, he supported the impeachment of Clinton.
And he also voted for Hillary Clinton.
Right. No.
And he was not, he was not a partisan for Trump as the other three had been against Trump. And he said the following. He said that there is a system, and this is the system. If the House subpoenas something from the executive has the right, the president, the White House has the right to say no and appeal the subpoena to the Supreme Court of the United States. And Turley argues the Supreme Court's job is to adjudicate disputes between the other two branches of
government. You don't have to cite Turley for that. You can cite Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78.
Yes, I know, but
he says the same thing.
Okay, you know that, though.
Right.
But now people are watching TV,
right?
And they're seeing Turley say this, and they and he says
that's
the job. That's how the system works.
Absolutely.
If you and therefore, it would only be obstruction of Congress or justice if the Supreme Court ruled in the favor of the House, as it did in the Nixon impeachment
hearings. And then Nixon, if he had refused to turn
over
the tapes, that would be obstruction.
And instead he
resigned.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And the answer is, it is such a violation of everything we stand for if you in some way hold the president responsible or guilty for going to the Supreme Court with an issue. Number one, am I saying it accurately? And number two, I keep asking you the same question, and maybe it's the same answer. How is it that lovely, bright, educated people say to me, this is what they say, you know, the president has destroyed the executive. And because he's destroyed the executive, the principle of the Supreme Court adjudicating between the executive and the legislative no longer applies.
Well, they're just wrong. Our separation of powers and checks and balances requires that the judges be the umpires between the two branches. And if a president feels that a subpoena involves privileged material, not only is he entitled to, it's the right thing to do, to assert the various privileges and leave it to the courts to decide. That can't be an obstruction of Congress. First of all, there is no such thing as obstruction of Congress. It's a made-up event. Obstruction of justice is in the statute books, but you can't find obstruction of Congress. It's just made up by Congress. And it would put Congress above the law. It would make them the superior branch of our government, that you'd have to listen to Congress, but not to the president, not to the courts. Courts are the umpire. Hamilton in Federalist 78 talked about any act of Congress that is in violation of the Constitution is void, and it's the job of the courts to determine which acts of Congress are void, which are valid.
Nancy Pelosi made a big point of saying that she would not encourage or even condone impeachment hearings unless it was a bipartisan process.
And Jerry Nadler said the same thing when Bill Clinton was being impeached.
Okay. Right. And then what seems to me, for political reasons, she did an about-face.
Right.
When I ask my friends, my lovely, wonderful friends, which time was she right? Was she right when she said it should be bipartisan? Or was she right now when she said, no, it doesn't need to be bipartisan? When was she right?
Clearly, the first time, Alexander Hamilton said the greatest danger to the impeachment process would be if impeachment turns on how many votes a particular party has rather than on the guilt or innocence of the person being impeached. That was the greatest danger, and we're now heading down that path. I call it Hamilton's nightmare, and we're leading ourselves to a path where impeachment has become partisan. The Senate is designed to protect against that by the two-thirds majority.
And if somebody were to say to you, Alan, you're with the Gatestone Institute now, which is described by others as a far-right organization, mm-hmm. which is anti-Muslim in much of its writings, and how could Alan Dershowitz be with the Gatestone Institute? And doesn't it really show that there has been a political shift in your soul, and you're now on Fox television all the time?
Because CNN banned me. They don't want me.
What do you mean CNN banned
you? CNN said they would never have me on because they didn't like my views on Donald Trump. I think they may be hopefully reconsidering, but for over a year and a half now, I have not been allowed to be on CNN.
Isn't that outrageous? Yeah. What about MSNBC?
Occasionally. Okay. But Fox calls me all the time.
Is there anything illegitimate about Fox?
Well, it's a very opinionated. It's like CNN. It's right-wing CNN. CNN is left-wing MSNBC. Walter Cronkite couldn't get a job today in the media because he's too balanced. You ask about Gatestone. I sit next to Joe Lieberman at Gatestone lunches. The Gatestone lunches are wonderful. They have people from every political perspective talking about a wide range of issues. The people who run it are wonderful people. I've never seen a single element of anti-Islam. Several of the leading people in Gatestone are Muslims, and Muslims who support democracy and who support Israel. So I'm proud to be associated with Gatestone.
By the way, there are reports that Donald Trump has reached out to you, Alan Dershowitz, and if he is in fact impeached and there's a trial in the Senate, the report is he is asking you to defend him. Is that story true?
Well, you know, I can't comment on any conversation I've had with the president. I was in the White House for the Hanukkah party. I did speak in the White House in favor of the president's executive order against anti-Semitism at universities, but I can't at this point go beyond that. I support the president in the Senate. I think the Senate should vote to dismiss the charges against him because I don't think they're constitutionally sound, but I can't comment about any conversations I've had with the president.
Okay. Then I'll ask it in a different way. Philosophically, would you ever be willing to defend either Donald Trump in the Senate or in principle a president who is charged with impeachment?
Of course. Of course I would. It would be a great honor to defend the presidency, to defend the Constitution. That's the way I would think of my role, but I can't comment on the specifics. But okay. In principle, of course.
Okay. We end by my simply asking you, give me the bottom line, give me a brief summary of why you think the impeachment process is a weaponizing of the law, and what its real danger is, and why, although you do not support Trump, mm-hmm. you are troubled to your core that so many lovely, bright, mm-hmm. intelligent, educated American Jews mm-hmm. are just blind and insist that the impeachment process is correct.
Look, I understand the people who have tremendous hatred and opposition. Remember that on the other side, when Obama was elected, there were people who had equal hatred. You just mentioned Obama and they just went nuts. We have elected divisive presidents, but that shouldn't in any way compromise the Constitution. And I'm there because the ACLU is not there. I'm the last man standing, the last liberal Democrat civil libertarian who will stand up for the Constitution without regard to the partisan politics. There were, you know, Elie Wiesel would have done that had he been alive. My friend Erwin Kotler in Canada does that. But there are very few of us today who are prepared to endure the wrath of people who feel strongly against us. But I'm going to continue to fight with all of my strength for principles. Principles and the rule of law, to me, are the crucial elements that make America the greatest country in the world.
Every now and then I get letters, how can I possibly support Alan Dershowitz? I think I told you, you're my hero.
Well, thank you.
What you've done, you just continue the good fight. You always have a home here.
I appreciate
that. No matter what.
I love being on your show because it's such good talk. It's like sitting in our living room and schmoozing.
Alan Dershowitz, whose most recent books are entitled The Case Against Impeaching Trump and Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of the Me Too Movement. And from my perspective, it is so wonderful that Alan's voice is still heard throughout the American scene and in the Jewish scene. And I'm betting one day the 92nd Street Y will call him and this nonsense will be lifted. By the way, as always, I invite you to be in touch with me with any thoughts or comments you may have to any of the ideas expressed here on this edition of L'Chaim. Please email me, write me, post on our Facebook page, or tweet me. I look forward to hearing from many of you. And remember, you can now take L'Chaim with you anywhere you go. You can hear this whole conversation again by downloading L'Chaim as a podcast. Wherever you download your podcast, you'll find L'Chaim. Please take us with you. And so until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. L'Chaim, my friends, to life.
L'Chaim is a presentation of Jewish Education in Media.
We would be pleased to send a complimentary DVD of this program to anyone who wishes to support JBS with a tax-deductible gift of $36, double chai or more. And we're especially pleased to remind you that thanks to a generous matching gift from the Cayley family, every new or increased dollar you donate to JBS will be worth double to JBS. Simply visit the JBS website at jbstv.org and click on the Donate button to make a donation by PayPal or your credit card. And please, indicate the program for which you would like a DVD. Or you can send your tax-deductible check to JBS, P.O. Box 180, Riverdale Station, Bronx, New York, 10471. And again, please remember to indicate which program you would like to receive with our compliments. And we thank you for your kind support.